This is Systems Radio, the podcast for scientists and engineers on the web at systemsradio.net. Systems Radio brings you relevant and detailed discussions on a variety of topics for the development of complex systems, which include systems thinking, systems science, and systems engineering. Thanks to our audience and partners for supporting the podcast.
This is Kent Palmer with Systems Radio, and I'm interviewing Lynn Troncalli today, and we're going to be talking about systems science and the systems processes that his work concentrates on. So would you like to say a few words, Lynn, to start off with?
I'd like to point out why I concentrate on systems processes. I think that's important. When I first started trying to unify systems theory, because they were all over the map, the various systems theories, incidentally, we don't even have a set of criteria to tell us what is a systems theory and what is not. What we have is people's life works, and some of them were doing systems theory and some systems applications. Some systems methods, some were doing systems tools, some were working in areas like systems engineering or biosystems. So we have this wealth of knowledge, but we don't even have criteria to tell us what is a systems theory or not. So that's the first thing that should be done, probably, so that we could try to unify systems theories, is understand what do we mean by a systems theory.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
So
when I say I was going to try to unify systems theories so that we had one powerful one with wide applicability. That in itself is a statement that has all these caveats to it. So what I started with way back in the 70s was concentrating on systems concepts. And at that time, Richard Erickson, who was managing director of the society and sort of one of my mentors, said, why don't you call them principal systems concepts? And I spent a lot of time setting up criteria for what principal systems concepts were, because at that time it was the founders giving papers and so on in general about a thing called general systems theory. And there was a lot of, within that community, a lot of excitement about that. And I kind of backed off on that by being more rigorous in my suggestion of what a principal systems concept was and what it was not. And so I threw out all taxonomic terms. And so some of the favorite terms of the systems people of that time and the founders, there were just a few as it turned out, like open and closed systems, actually were kind of thrown out because they're more taxonomic terms describing different types of systems rather than what a system does when it works. I wanted to find out how systems work and thereby how they don't work, which eventually became systems pathology. So I concentrated on principal systems concept, and I had a long list of those even then. Over the years, I've changed my emphasis to some degree to not talk about just principal systems concepts, but to try to focus on processes. Because as I progressed in studying the various natural sciences, which is many of the systems we know best and can study best because they've been around for billions of years, in the various sciences, the sciences focus on processes when you stop and think of it. Continental drift in geology, DNA and genetics in biology, volcanism, climatology, precession of planets, rotation of galaxies, association with black holes, the various types of astronomical objects. When you start looking at them, what they study is the processes behind which they maintain themselves. And so I thought that would be a good focus. And thus was born the idea of focusing on systems processes. There was one additional step to that, though, that was important, I think. That is derived from actually a paper by Russ Acuff, who many times argued with me. It's funny that he was a source of an inspiration. he wrote a paper one time that I cited in my very first paper in 1982 or whatever it is in this series. He had a paper which concentrated or actually complained that the founders weren't talking about how the various systems concepts interacted with each other. Mind you, he didn't do much of that in the paper. He was just complaining. He was a great critic of the early founders because he was from the social science side. And I recognize that the processes, perhaps the most important part of them, were that they interacted with each other. I already thought they were axiomatic. My first paper in 72 in ISSS talked about the origins of hierarchical levels from the action of systems field axioms. I was already concentrating on processes without being aware of it in these principal systems concepts, but I called them axiomatic. And I was already talking about their interaction, but it wasn't conscious. And so in the 82 or that first paper in System of Systems Processes, I started talking about linkage propositions, naming the influences between the systems processes. Now I know that you are a advocate of meta models. You have your own, as a matter of fact, which incidentally we should compare with the criteria for systems theory, if we ever wanted to compare such candidates.
Mm-hmm.
But you're interested in meta models. When you stop and think of it, raising the interaction between the systems processes and codifying it by the linkage proposition raises the whole theoretical debate one step higher. So it becomes even a greater system. You can call it a system of systems processes then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've found more and more is when you talk about one systems process, you have to talk about the other. And this also is one of my criticisms of a lot of people who work in the field because they pick one systems concept or one, what I would call a systems process, and they raise it to the highest level, like Forrester's work is mostly on feedbacks, or if you talk about synergy, you might be talking about Peter Corning or Herbert Haken and their work. Even Buckminster Fuller talked a lot about synergy. Jim Miller talked a lot about hierarchy. He was very interested in hierarchy. So each one of them is focused on just one of the systems process, which is very good because you need many workers to elucidate or expand the knowledge base for any one systems process. The error I think that I would point out as a criticism is when they raise that one above all the others and try to interpret everything in terms of that one systems process. And so mine are all kind of equal, and there's many of them, and then they have these linkage propositions, and thus we call it a system of systems processes.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And so I understand that one of the things that you've been doing is trying to look at the list of that you had, which was over 100, and trying to make that list shorter by putting together the systems processes that work together. How have you been doing that?
Well, first of all, why did I do that? It was because of complaints of my students. I had some online distance learning courses where we had people from several countries, Janet McIntyre from Australia, for example, Lynn Rasmussen from Hawaii, Luke Frenchu and Kurt McNamara from Minnesota, other people from Canada, from the East Coast. And they complained because there were so many systems processes. Now, mind you, that made me feel good because I wanted to shock people with the fact that there were many so that they would get out of this conundrum of focusing just on one.
Mm.
Now, people focus just on one because if they're interested in general theories of systems, they want one that explains all. Mm. It almost sounds like something from Tolkien's Hobbit Land or something.
Right.
All of us philosophers want one great rule, right? Mm-hmm. And so I understand the human tendency to do that. I just don't see nature operating that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so by using a large number, I wanted to shock them. Well, I did shock them. And even today, I just did a course for some people who are interested in sustainability. at our Center for Regenerative Studies at Cal Poly Pomona. And these were one guy and seven young women, very enthusiastic and intelligent. But they were put off by the fact that there were so many systems processes, because unless you have a couple years to study them, what are you going to do with so many? So I've achieved this shock and awe part. But everyone started complaining about why couldn't we break down the list or make it smaller? And so we started to cluster them into smaller groupings. And so those would make it more manageable. Mm. So sometimes I clustered them by putting them where they had like function, like they created the structure for a system, or they caused adaptation and evolution in the system and so on. And so another way was to put them in stages of a life cycle. I think there's a kind of a generalized system life cycle that would be very useful too. And that was in one of the early papers on this too. And that would cluster them also. I've clustered them in ways of prerequisite knowledge. Like some you have to know something about something else. Like you have to know about flows before you can learn about feedback, because there's flows involved. You have to know about positive and negative feedback if you're going to know about cycles and oscillations, because they have positive and negative feedback. To talk about self-organization, you have to know about positive and negative feedback. So they line up in a way of learning. And so for the integrated science program, which uses the systems processes as integrated frameworks for learning many sciences, I put them in the curriculum in order of learning. So there's different ways to cluster them. Mm. And each has its own fascination and utility. I guess not fascination, perhaps, but mostly utility for function for different purposes. And so that's progressing, along with me shortening the list. A couple colleagues and I have been meeting to try to go over the list we had before. And I found out that in my effort for shock and awe and adding things to the list, I had added some things which probably are more identifying functions or identifying features of some of the things that were already on the list. So if you talk about chaotic processes and you talk about, say, singularities, or words like that, they are definition or bifurcations. They are definitions that actually belong under chaos. So I put them under there. Or the different types of feedback, positive, negative, coupled, feed forward, are all aspects of feedback. So I put it under feedback. So I've now reduced the list just recently to about 55. I think that's plenty for shock and awe, but maybe more manageable.
So when you say identifying features and functions, what's that mean?
Actually, those started because I was trying to help young college students who were anywhere from freshman to senior, who knew nothing about science, discover the systems processes in different fields for themselves. So when we humans look at something new, we look for little hooks that we can use from our previous knowledge that would help us identify them. And that's why I came up with identifying features. So what they are is, you might say, memes or things we would be conscious of, that we could look at something new and look for that feature. And if we had enough of a cluster of features, it would tell us that, yo, you're looking at cycling or you're looking at feedback. For example, feedback, there usually is a set point, or it's either set by humans or by evolution. And that's what the output is measured against for there to be feedback to change the system. So that's an identifying feature. In cycles, it might be stages that are in a sequence, or repeat, some periodicity. So I don't put periodicity as a process. I put it under cycling as a process. Even oscillations I put together with cycling, because it's repeated cycles in some particular manner. So these identifying features, usually I try to list around 7 to 12, would help a person recognize it in a new domain. And of course, that comes down to the critical essence of systems theory, and that is what is common to many different types of systems, no matter what they are, mm-hmm. or manifestations of systems. And that's this word isomorphy that the founders came up with, but which has been terribly poorly defined. Mm-hmm. So in order to see the isomorphy in these different disciplines, you're looking at different real things. You have to have these identifying features. And identifying functions is much the same. It's just, instead of it being an arrangement of parts or a structural that we can identify, it's the utility that is accomplished by that process. Every system in systems engineers, especially and in humans, has a purpose or a goal. We humans like to talk about those things. Mm. But that's because we're humans, we're conscious beings. But remember, before there were maybe 5 million years ago conscious human beings, there was nature for, what would it be? It would be something like 13,000 million years. There were systems then. Mm-hmm. There were no conscious beings to denote or connote what they should do. Now that, mind you, is going beyond the concept of religion and God and so on. That's another whole thing about purpose that we'd have to discuss. But so what is goal and purpose to humans, and for instance engineers, is in nature function. And the natural scientist will not let you use the word purpose or goal because it implies conscious design. Mm. And of course, we think systems evolve themselves in the natural sciences. So function, identifying functions would be what is achieved. Like in hierarchy, it achieves a reduction of complexity to make interaction possible. Mm-hmm. Without hierarchical levels and clustering, you wouldn't have that. It increases interactivity, so it has many beneficial effects on what a system is and what systems are possible through that function. So if you put together identifying features and functions, you could go to another planet, maybe, and have a much easier time identifying the systems because you had a more general view of what systems do rather than just the particulars on our planet.
Right. So
mind you, I should add one other thing. These are very useful then for teaching about the systems processes. Mm. Because every identifying feature and function is a little lesson in itself to learn, mm-hmm. and then apply across many different disciplines, domains, and scales.
So when you're talking about isomorphy, then there's this question of, you know, well, how do you prove an isomorphy? How does that work?
That is such an excellent question, because the founders never talked much about that. And that was why general systems theory was probably criticized in its beginnings, because there was no evidence or proof. People started with a basic set of assumptions from their awareness. If we go back to the first Macy conference, for example, where Margaret Mead was there with Ken Boulding, I think, was there, and Ralph Gerard was there, and Norbert Wiener was there. They recognized, just as conscious beings, that there was a lot of feedbacks in the electronics as well as in the cultures, as well as in geology and in economics for Boulding. So there were feedbacks everywhere. So they came up with this word isomorphy, which unfortunately was borrowed, and we have a great deal of problem with this in all of the system science endeavors. And that is, we use words promiscuously. Mm-hmm. Isomorphy actually came from mathematics. Mm-hmm. It meant the same form to the mathematical equations between two different systems of mm-hmm. math, or two different systems that were modeled in math. And in this case, it kind of meant iso, like an isosceles triangle, similarity, and morph meant shape. Well, but shape in this sense was used in the broadest sense of the term shape. I mean, almost philosophical shape. Mm-hmm. Almost meme shape, if you will. Mm-hmm. So isomorphy was prominent in the four original goals of the society, which were to find the isomorphies in any one system, describe essentially how they help the system work, and then to show them across different systems. So there wasn't a necessity to rebuild a new model for every new system, and also for help and discovery. Now, they had a few exemplars, you might say, like feedback, which were almost immediately understandable to people who had studied any particular system in depth, because they're everywhere. Mm. I mean, they're even in politics. Much of our discussion nowadays is between the Republicans who don't want regulation and the Democrats who maybe want too much regulation, and so they fight back and forth. So there's regulation everywhere. Everyone tries to raise their kids, or were raised as a kid, and they know all about regulations, mm-hmm. or feedbacks. So that was one of the exemplars that was immediately understandable. But since that time, we've come up with many more such cases of isomorphy. But no one has systematically proved isomorphy. So how do you prove something? You go to the sciences. Well, you don't have to go to the sciences. You well know from your philosophical studies, you can go to rhetoric or logic or whatever, and there's a series of criteria for proving something. But in the natural sciences, you prove something through asking nature a question and getting some unambiguous and consistent answer that's never always correct, but seems to be correct most of the time. And from these laws, you build theories. Well, it sounds like system science is totally different from that, because it's comparing across different manifest systems. Up till now, the experiments can only be utilized to show a process, let's get to that word process again, and elucidate it in a particular system. So we talk about photosynthesis, and we've gone by reductionism further and further down this scalar hierarchical levels to find the actual molecules that are responsible. And so we know a lot about photosynthesis. But if you take conscious thought, we have no idea. We've gone down the scalar levels. We know a lot about various neurotoxins as well as neural messengers, which connect the neurons. We know how many hundreds of billions of neurons we have, but we have no idea. Well, I shouldn't say we have no idea. We have isolated test cases of how we interpret vision and so on. But higher conscious thought, we just really don't know. So when we talk about proving isomorphy, what could we mean? The founders don't give us any guidance. Many of the systems theories don't give us guidance because they do a lot of assumptions. There's an awful lot of logical statements, which science, incidentally, has learned to beware of, because we've found out time and again that what seems to be a correlation isn't a cause and effect, and what we're looking for is a series of cause and effects. To make it worse, I have a whole talk on nonlinear cause and effects. Nowadays, we know that there are many things affecting an outcome, and it makes it much harder to trace this cause and effect that experiments are set up for. So we compound the problem many times when we say we want to look at an isomorphy across disciplines, because we're looking across not across the general scientific method, but looking across its particular applications to particular manifestations. So a geological experiment doesn't look like one that I'm doing in the laboratory with a model organism to test whether compound A affects compound B for a particular phenomena that's only found in the plasmodium of this particular slime mold, let's say, or that particular tissue culture cell. How do you compare across such huge differences in systems, as astronomical to geological to biological? And that remains a problem. So what I've done to try to prove isomorphy, to make a science of systems, is to take the natural sciences, take the experimental proofs. I mean, we don't call them proofs, we call them experimental evidence. You know, proof sounds like you're talking about a mathematical proof and or a logical proof, which have some relationship to each other, but not much relationship to trying to find out something about nature. Taking that evidence that has been proven with the scientific method of each of the sciences, and finding out what that science says about the process on its level, scalar level. Often the disciplines are scalar levels of reality, or clusters of scalar level, like biology is a big cluster and it's overlapped with chemistry, but then chemistry's overlapped with astronomy too. That's why you call it cosmochemistry and so on. So, and physics goes through all of them, of course. I mean, we have physics of the way we move in our skeletons and our body, much less the physics of the interaction of the electrons and the protons and their van der Waals shapes in the molecules, macromolecules. So we try to then compare across these different realms of reality, you might mm-hmm. say, discipline, scalar levels, and we compare the identifying features and functions. So if we've taken a systems process like feedback or cycles and set up a dozen identifying features, we can then look for that in cycles in particular disciplines. And I maintain, and I'm sure there'll be a large amount of discussion about this in the future, or I hope there is anyway, some people say that doesn't prove anything because you're comparing across scientific method applications. And other people will say, well, at least that's a lot of evidence. So, for example, I could go through maybe 60 case studies of cycles in different disciplines like astronomy, chemistry, biology, physics, geology, computer science, human systems, economics, from that to behavior to civilizations, and say show feedbacks or show cycling, and that they follow the same identifying feature. To me, that would be the beginnings of a science of systems, because it would show or prove that it is isomorphic. The challenges, I suspect, would be that some people will just say that you're comparing apples and oranges because they're different systems. I mean, after all, we've got that wonderful saying, you're comparing apples and oranges, right? Mm-hmm. Aren't apples and oranges both fruits?
Right, right.
Yeah, so at the same time we're saying you can't compare apples and oranges, we've already compared them and found them to be right. similar amongst themselves as different from other things. So hopefully a science of isomorphy would evolve. But you notice that no one does this. There's a few books I could point to that do it, and they're not heralded texts or anything. Obviously, Jim Miller did it extensively for living systems in his particular way. He didn't look particularly at systems processes. He looked at what he called his subsystems, and that made it more difficult, I think. But other people, there's an Asian author I know of who compared physics, because she's a physicist, with economics and biology. There's just three, disciplines. And was showing isomorphy of certain things like chaos across them. And the reason we have some of these things like self-organization is that they've already been compared in case studies. But you very rarely come across the collection that actually... collection is the word, key word there, brings that together so mm-hmm. you can see it. And that's what we're trying to do.
So I was looking at your presentation on cycles, and the impression that I got was this impression that, in some sense, we're driving the point home, and we're looking at the stating the obvious in a way. But what you're saying is that we haven't stated the obvious strongly enough so that it is obvious. I mean, that's one thing about a proof, right? Is that anyone should be able to do that proof and come up with the same answer. And so I guess one of my takeaways from what you're saying is that, people have done limited comparisons between just a few disciplines or taking one concept across a lot of disciplines, but no one has kind of been systematic about going through all of the disciplines and saying, okay, this is a cycle in all of these disciplines, like you did with your presentation.
Yes, and I think that you have a internal problem here that you don't recognize, and that's because you're the founder of Systems Radio, and you've always been a systems-level philosopher. And so when you say the phrase stating the obvious, It's because you're a true believer to begin with. Now, right away, I say true believer with a certain amount of jocularity, because the fact is that we're not concerned with belief here. Right? We're trying to make a science of systems.
Right, right.
But there's a massive number of people out there who do not have that perspective to begin with. Mm. For them to attain that aha moment and be convinced that there are these things called systems, and that nature has been spinning off systems since its beginning at different scalar levels for 13 billion years, and probably will beyond that, and many in different, maybe even different universes, for them to come to that recognition would take this kind of proof. If it was acceptable.
So we're talking about the reductionist nature of science, right? I mean,
well, the reductionist nature is so highly focused that you can't do this, can you? Mm-hmm. Because you have to compare. Mm. Now, most scientists get very, very overworked, and they work very hard, mind you, in their sub specialty. So one of my sons is a geneticist, but he's not a geneticist. He works in cancer, but he's not a cancer geneticist, because he works on melanoma. But he's not a cancer melanoma geneticist, because he works on certain tools and techniques for certain genes. And so you're lucky if you can get command of the sub specialty.
Right.
So you're not just dealing with the cell, you're dealing with microtubes. You're not just dealing with microtubes, you're dealing with towel fibers. You're not just dealing with towel fibers, but how they go wrong in pathologies like the towelopathies. And you're completely, I mean, if you're going to run a lab, you have to concentrate on every paper that comes out in that discipline and try to extend just that little bit of knowledge. Well, how can you compare across this vast panorama that we're talking about here if you have such blinders on? And the blinders I'm trying to portray is very useful for humanity, because they get really good knowledge out, but not the kind of knowledge that we're looking for. And we're not looking for airy-fairy knowledge, because we would say that the isomorphies and systems architectures are extremely important. So in order to do this kind of science, if you call it science, system science, you have to do comparisons. Mm. Now, comparisons have been very powerful in the conventional sciences. It wasn't until we started doing comparative anatomy and comparative developmental biology that we understood evolution. Mm. It wasn't until we started doing comparative genetics. So today we have comparative genomics, but then there was comparative physiology. There was comparative taxonomy. Every time even one of the disciplines has gone comparative, it's been very useful. Let me jump to astronomy. It wasn't until they started to look at the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram and began to understand that the stars had different stages in one unified life cycle that they found that there was such a thing as the evolution or life cycle of stars. Before that, those were different objects in nature. Mm. And we still don't understand completely the relationship between a galaxy and its black hole, or a black hole and a massive protostars in the beginning, so-called third generation stars that go backwards. It's very, very interesting that comparison is so important even to the conventional sciences. But even then, they want to stay within their discipline,
right,
and don't do the kind of comparisons that we're talking about to detect and convince people about isomorphy. And then not just convince them about one, but many isomorphies. And then not just that, but how those interact with each other with those linkage
problems. Yeah, I remember when I took astronomy, you know, as an undergraduate, you know, the teacher made this analogy of walking out into a forest, and you're going to look and see a lot of different trees and a lot of different plants, but the trees are going to be different sizes. And by seeing it, by focusing in on a species, then you can see that that tree has a life cycle, and you're seeing the life cycle before you in all of the instances at different stages in the life cycle. And so I thought that was very powerful, because it kind of said, you know, it brought it down to something that you can actually do, which is walk into a forest and see trees, but then you're looking at all these stars, and how all the stars are in you know, different stages of the life cycle. And so now they have an idea of the life cycle of stars, and then they went on to talk about the life cycles of galaxies, right? So we have life cycles of galaxies now because there's so many galaxies in these various states that we see with the Hubble telescopes, for instance. So it seems to me that what we're talking about here, in a sense, is a field theory, right? These systems processes seem to be in a field. And basically what we're doing is we're trying to say, okay, the field is all phenomena in some sense, but we keep looking at it through these different specialties, and somehow we need to have a cross-cutting concern. In software, we have this idea of a cross-cutting concern, where if there's some little problem that's scattered all throughout the system, then you can take that problem out and do aspect-oriented programming rather than object-oriented programming and focus on that concern. So it seems like the systems processes, in a way, is this cross-cutting concern where you're going to see the same process occurring through these different phenomena rather than, like, in one species. Does that make sense?
Oh, all those things that you mentioned. First of all, the analogy between the forest and astronomy is very good. And it's interesting to say that you heard that in a class, because that meant the astronomer had seen that. And that's a very good, what you might call, case study of that perspective. But then the wider perspective you talk about is very true. And my contention is we're going to need system science in the future on two levels. One of them is, I taught evolution and origins of life for 30 years or so. And I always said, even in the beginning, that there were many planets that were like ours. And they're now just finding exoplanets. And mm-hmm. It's inevitable they're going to find some like ours. Mm-hmm. But we don't even need them like ours. They're going to find other vast arrays of complex beings, maybe not as complex as us, maybe more complex than us. I mean, I think it's just inevitable. When we go to these other planets, this kind of meta-knowledge is going to be very, very important for a quick assessment and understanding of what's going on. We can't continue as intelligent human beings to only see the specific aspects of things that you just pointed out, mm-hmm. because it takes us too long then to build it into the dynamic and then build it into the systems. If you look at organisms that are very simple, like some of the sea organisms, they have a sessile life cycle stage and a mobile life cycle stage, and they look extremely different. And there's a number of cases in the literature and the history of biology where they've been labeled as different organisms until they found out they were one. Mm. We can't afford the centuries to do that in the future. Mm-hmm. There's going to have to be this meta-knowledge in the future to do space exploration. But I even go further than that, just to really upset the apple cart. Past colleagues I've read did the anthropic principle, which says we just happen to live in a universe that's really designed for us, or vice versa. They had a weak form of it and a strong form of it. Well, I call what we've been talking about system science as the weak form of system science. In my book, I'm going to state that the strong form of system science goes beyond that. It says you have to know system science in order to do well at the reductionist sciences. Mm. That in the future, it will lead to faster recognition of useful and fruitful hypotheses. It will help understand, just in the way you were saying, you know, you kind of took us through the steps of building up to a system's understanding. But if you start with a system's understanding, you can more efficiently go through those steps and quickly go through those steps. So I'm saying that subatomic particle physics and certain types of mathematics will someday look at system science in order to find the source of their advances. Mm. Now that's just straight out heresy right now. That's not only saying there's reductionism and there's holism, it's saying that some of these systems architecture approaches will be essential for reductionism in the future.
Right, that's interesting.
I don't mind being a heretic. Well, just as long as you don't burn me.
Another analogy that comes to mind is the analogy that, you know, like if you have a bunch of transparencies and you stack them up, and on one layer you're drawing one kind of diagram, and on the next layer another type of diagram, and say the different diagrams are related to different disciplines. So on one you're saying the feedback here, and then on another you're saying what the feedback is on another discipline and another. But then there's looking through all of the transparencies stacked up, and seeing what is common across the whole set of transparencies, rather than, and then what's interesting is what is the differences. You know, in a sense, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get through the commonality so that we can understand the differences. Because in this field of systems processes, what's interesting is, okay, certain kinds of cycles occur in many, many different disciplines. But the question is, okay, what is the ones that are specific to a particular kind of ontic level, you know, say life, or, you know, quarks, or astronomy, you know, widely divergent levels, which ones are the same and which ones are specific to those levels. That ought to tell us something fundamental about nature.
And about those levels.
And about those levels.
Yes. It's funny that you started with a graphic portrayal, which is interesting. Radio, we're trying to give a picture with our words. When I first started out giving these talks in the 70s, I had my most primitive original picture of the clusters of systems processes, and there would be these blocks, and then there would be little lines going to circles, which were the individual systems processes, and some dashed lines between them. If you can imagine that network in your mind, it was a very crudely drawn network. Mm-hmm. Well, I used to show that network, and then I started showing something else, and that is, I realized that most of the disciplines were just different scalar levels, and so I took that drawing and made it at different sizes. So I used the copier to make reductions of it.
Oh,
and then I made transparencies of those in different colors, and then I cut them out and put them in one transparency. You remember we used to use the plastic transparencies, colored ones? You know, it was advanced when you got a colored one.
Right.
Most of the people showed black and white. So you had these different levels, and you'd have the network small, and then slightly occluding and inside, subsuming another network which was larger than another one at different colors. And in one transparency, then I could show exactly the thing you were talking about.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
I was doing that in the 70s, but then I never could figure out how to do that with a PowerPoint.
Right.
Or didn't do it.
Right.
And so I lost that particular graphic thing. But we were thinking exactly along the same lines.
Right.
And this is why I often say that if you look at nature, it's been throwing off systems at different scalar levels constantly, but it's been throwing off the same systems when you look at these systems architectures, because only certain systems architectures work in our time-space continuum, which is always the construct we're in, of course.
Right.
I'm not sure other universes even have systems, but if they don't, you know, that's for another study. But in any case, if they're throwing off these systems, the reason we get isomorphies is because they are forced into, or the many variants that come out, which always happens through the principle of plenitude and so on, the many variants that came out are kind of forced into the same kinds of systems architecture, and only to last long enough to succeed, or at least to become succeeds for us to become conscious anyway of them. As a result, in a sense, the system sciences are a huge and deep study of the origins of any particular scalar level that exists, or any discipline, in kind of the way you were describing in your original diagram.
So the idea that you were putting across there a minute ago was the idea that if we understood how the generation of systems within space-time occurred that perhaps we could understand better how they differentiated themselves at different scales. Is that that's the basic idea, that there's some kind of core process that's occurring that is constrained in some way such that there are commonalities produced but differences also at the various scalar levels, and understanding that difference between the commonalities and the differences should tell us more about what happens at the scalar levels, how the constraints change at those levels. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, and one of the studies that has to be done for systems application in the future, you've now alluded to this in your last two comments, and that is that there are differences also between systems at different levels, is to do a study of the range of validity of any particular system's process. When I was doing systems allometry, which I thought I had started as a new field, I became very sensitive to this because some of the parameters that we were using to measure things disappeared and some new ones appeared as we went across the scalar levels. So, for example, we still have this problem when we talk about systems processes, like the concept of reproduction is different in living systems because of it proceeding from fundamentally DNA to having many entities of the same type in a physical system, which doesn't have DNA to guide that. So what happened to reproduction? Did it just start at the living systems level? Was there a primitive before it that we haven't recognized because we haven't learned to look that way? Is there a similarity between the many repeats of a particular type or size of object in nature, I mean just the stars themselves, and what we call reproduction now? So the further studies will be able to actually denote when a system's process becomes dominant or you might say recessive in various scalar levels, and how they give rise to each other. And that will help with this variation thing you're talking about. But I think the variation thing goes beyond that, too, because there are certain peculiarities of particular levels that may not be isomorphic at all. And you can't distinguish those if there's all the noise of all the other things that are going on. You have to be able to discriminate between them. And that won't be possible unless you have a good science of systems. So overall, it, as we progress with more knowledge on this, there's more potential for it being useful. That also would apply to two very practical things, and that's systems application and systems pathology. You can't talk about pathology, and you can describe normality to some degree. And that is a very elusive and context-dependent description. And so you need this greater knowledge in order to describe the pathologies and to describe some possible applications, exaggerations, if you will. Nature is excellent in exaggerating certain subparts of a system in order to serve a certain function for that particular species in that particular environment for this particular geologic period. As some people in biology have pointed out, certain things are variants without a purpose. They're just variations that come up because there's a mechanism to produce variation, which is essential for any system, at least biological or living system. And those variants can last for a long period of time and be almost purposeless. But it's a function of the necessity for the variation for the other parts of the system, which wouldn't succeed long enough for us to recognize them. I always say succeed long enough for us to recognize them because that's what we're dealing with, our recognition of things. But that's not to say that that is the central thing. I'm not a reconstructionist in terms of science at all. I think that's nonsense.
Well, it seems like this flip that you're talking about where you say that system science becomes more basic in some sense, more a kind of deeper unification. You know, the physicists are looking for a unified theory. This is like a a deeper level of unification that you're discussing. But it seems like, you know, one way of looking at it is that it's kind of like a kind of Platonism, in the sense that it's a dynamic Platonism. You know, Plato had this concept that there were ideas that were outside of experience that governed how experience worked, right? And so it seems like this is kind of saying, okay, there's some ideal system outside of experience that when it comes into the constraints of space-time causes these differentiations at many different scales, and also because of the constraints of space-time also produce differences, and that somehow that is the deepest level of knowledge we can have about the way things work, because we're seeing this interaction between this ideal kind of view of what a system is, with all of its systems processes, all of its linkage propositions, all that's pointing back to some source that causes all that variety.
Well, this is an excellent statement of a conundrum or a huge chasm that we're going to face, and that is, you mentioned Plato and the concept of ideal versus real. Aristotle functioned on the basis more of his observations of the real, mm-hmm. and that's where all science went. Mm-hmm. And ideal went the way of all religion, and we have a huge chasm that's growing between the two. I want to state baldly at the outset here, in relation to that systems science subsumes both of those positions in a way that they would think it impossible, because the one might require belief in this thing outside of reality, and science will only study reality. Mm-hmm. I would say that system science goes beyond our time-space continuum. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of our conundrums nowadays that the physics people are facing, because they're at the limits of our observations of our reality, are due to the fact that there is this extension beyond our space-time, and we just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So the paradoxes which are arising in physics, and the problem between, say, relativistics of Einstein and quantum theory and quantum mechanics, are really at the interface with this breakthrough that's going to see the system sciences are beyond that. They're the source of the answer, actually. Mm-hmm. Let me just try a mental experiment here to kind of make that more concrete. What if our universe of matter was actually, because duality is so important on every level that we've looked at, is part of a dual universe where there's a coextant antimatter universe which has its own laws. Mm. And only when there are a breakthrough between the two do you have annihilation, which would be the quasars in our universe, mm-hmm. which then degrade by entropy because it's a broken asymmetry. This dual universe is the full asymmetry. Mm-hmm. That's why we have the flow of time in our universe. It creates our time and space and our matter. Mm. You can see that we're talking about system science concepts or processes that go beyond our space-time configuration, that would go beyond the conundrums that we're having, the paradoxes.
Right.
We can't see beyond our paradox because we can't see beyond our time-space limits. Mm. So now, this sounds a little bizarre, and I remember telling Kip Thorne about this at dinner back in the 70s, and he thought I was crazy. Over the 30 years since then, he's come closer and closer to some of these ideas. Not this broad an idea, but he certainly has changed his tune, so to speak, working with Stephen Hawking and challenging each other and coming up with the kind of the glass ceiling, or, you know, of their ideas in physics and that approach. Now, that doesn't mean system science is ready to do that yet, but I just did that thought experiment just to see how ideas could go beyond our time-space continuum, to give an example of exactly what you were saying. Hmm. Now, what does that say about the ideational versus the reality? I'm still a scientist, and I'm still immersed in the real systems and comparing those to get the systems processes. But I think we system scientists are too, or have been, too much on the defense. We should be on the offense. We should be asking the real systems people, why do these isomorphies exist in the fundamental processes of the systems that have manifested themselves?
Mm.
Could this be chance that they just occurred on all these scalar levels?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Come on, give me a reason why they exist.
Mm.
And they're going to be forced to say there must be a function for these. In other words, we go at it the opposite way. Rather than saying that this is an idea in our heads, we're saying that this is a necessity in the reality. And that's why we can do the comparison afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some purists will say, oh, you're doing the comparison in your conscious heads, and so you're creating it. We can never argue with them. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, what they're saying is something that we, you know, you can't deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we wouldn't even be talking if we didn't have consciousness.
Right.
But the point is, our consciousness is dictated, or to some degree, to a large degree, guided by our constant experiences and our senses of the real things out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's the things that happen over and over again that become our ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Chinese say, it thinks in me, I think it's a much better way than saying, I think, which we do in the Western world.
Right, right.
But their kind of concept, it thinks in me, it's showing that our brains are open modelers of what is presented to us. Sometimes it could be wrong and abstract, but oftentimes it's the repeated things that nature does to us. And so, yes, we can go back to Plato, but it's not the same dichotomy between ideas and reality now. Now it's that the reality has dictated the ideas, and further, that the reality has been forced into those commonalities which become our ideas,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because they're reality.
Right.
They're the ultimate reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different way of looking at that very long time controversy, which is continuing just as heated today as it was then.
Yeah. Well, I guess the point is that what we're seeing here is that there might be a, you know, there's mathematics, and so, you know, there's this whole controversy about, you know, whether mathematics is ideal or just conventional. But the point is that you can do proofs in mathematics. And so because you can do proofs in mathematics, that becomes our measure for what an isomorphy is. If we're going to prove isomorphies, you know, our model for that is mathematics. But what we're saying is that also there is a something between physical reality and, say, mathematics, which is a set of these systems processes that span, like mathematics spans many, many different disciplines. So these span many, many different disciplines. And so it's like developing a kind of mathematics which has this physical manifestation, but also has the more ideal properties of mathematics, so that if you knew enough about it, then you could tinker with it like they tinker with math and say, come up with different kinds of systems that have never existed. We don't find them, but we could combine the systems processes in that way and then see what happens. So I think one of the ideas that you had was the idea of system simulation, which would touch on that idea of creating different kinds of systems and then seeing whether or not we can find real things in the world that come from that combination of the systems processes through new linkage propositions, for instance.
Well, one of the papers I would love to see, and I don't know, maybe it's been done already. I've come across several examples, but I'm not clever enough to put them in the same pot to incubate this paper. But There are many cases where pure abstract mathematics have come up with a knowledge that then becomes 20 years, a century afterward, important to a new field of physical science. Is that not true?
Right, yeah.
If we could collect several of those examples, what is that saying? That's telling us that the ideas of mathematics and the formalisms, the manipulations, after all, which you use to extend mathematics, mm-hmm. have captured something very real about real systems, because they result in real systems afterwards, or interpreting real systems in a way that we couldn't interpret them before.
Right.
So similarly, we would say by analogy, systems processes could do the same thing in just the way that you were saying. We could, if they truly are capturing something that's true about real systems, they could be used for engineering real systems in the future, or for interpreting systems that we've never come across before. Mm. We talk about watching a sunset and a rainbow on Earth, but there are the equivalents of sunsets and rainbows on all other planets, and we're going to come across wonders of the universe if we become a spacefaring species that we never could have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to vacation in the Grand Canyon, some future family will go to vacation in some object-oriented stuff that we can't imagine on some other planetary system or whatever in some other region of the galaxy. I don't think we'll get beyond the galaxy. We may not even get to the other planets. But there are ways to take the system's processes and then overemphasize or manipulate them in a way that would create new engineering products, too. So, yes, I agree that there's lots of possibilities. But first we have to get down to, you know, just as they did with mathematics, that they came up with the tools and manipulations, the formalizations, processes, literally, that you could go through, algorithms, to change the mathematics. Those have to be rigorously set up for systems, too.
Right. So that's kind of looking at the horizon of where systems science could go in the future if we could become rigorous enough in our definition of these central axioms or principles or systems processes and then their relationships to each other. So do you see that as something that is a near-term thing that might happen, or is this something that, is further out?
I like to talk about the anthill of humanity. We're all scurrying around doing lots of things, and maybe only 1% of our population of many billions now are scientists and engineers. But that 1% is a growing number. Now, of that, maybe only 1% are system sensitives, you might say. By systems education, maybe we could get many more people involved. Mm. If I look across my life now, I'm almost 70. It's unimaginable that I've gotten that far. But with that perspective, I would have to say I am both optimistic and pessimistic. I think it's going to take an anthill of humanity to follow all of these leads and make this more rigorous. Mm. I'm trying to get together collaboratives now to do that. And the internet certainly is helping a great deal in our ability to cooperate. Mm. But I want to tell you, when I was in high school, I started an organization called the Research Society Systems in high school. It was a research society, I was thinking of large numbers, obviously back then even, that studied systems in order to improve societal systems, in order to improve our lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes way back. I am just now beginning to, we're talking about bringing together people who are working in widely different emphases, like synergy, mentioned, and thermodynamics we could mention, cycling we could mention, you know, self-organization. There are people who are dedicated to each one of these, but they're not dedicated to how they interact with the other ones very much. But they're deepening the knowledge of those. But I'm also starting to find people who want to bring all this together. So it's on the cusp of a possibility. But I would think it's going to take an anthill of humanity a very long time to do a good job at this. It's just gosh, aren't we excited to be at the beginnings of it? Mm. See, the founders saw a vision, but they didn't develop it very much. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was knocked down, because it was mostly vision. We have the possibility of making it real if we can cooperate. Mm. Now, if I look across those 50 years since the Research Society Systems with a group of high school students, the amazing thing that's happened is systems consciousness has invaded many, many more disciplines. So I can talk about systems biology now, and it's huge, hugely funded. They're advertising for systems biologists, which is interesting because we don't even have any courses in it hardly. Unfortunately, it's very tool-bound. There's systems engineering, which is mostly tool-bound too, I might say, mm-hmm. but at least it's there. Too bad they don't study system science. There's systems chemistry. If you look up systems chemistry on Google, you'll find many thousands of hits. Not as much as systems biology, but a lot. There are whole departments in universities across the nation which are called Earth System Science, which is a much newer aspect of the geology departments. Some are still traditional, but most of them, Earth System Science is progressive. There's systems medicine, systems immunology. You can see ads for systems neurology. I think you get the picture. The natural sciences are becoming more systems oriented. Most of the institutes for complex systems have physicists on the staff and mathematicians. And of course, anytime you talk about modeling or simulation, you're automatically talking about systems. I remember telling some of my faculty in biology when I was chair there about systems, and systems biology was going to be big. And the ecologist said, we've been dealing with systems all along. There's nothing new there. Notice the parochial thinking there. There's nothing new there. Baloney. And I could say worse terms if this wasn't a general family rated program. But it's true, we can learn a lot from systems ecology, but systems ecology and its modeling and simulation have been around for a long time. And of course, I don't have to say much about climate modeling and its skeptics. Mm-hmm. What a political debate that has been. So over my lifetime, we've gone from only the conventional sciences and a few quirky people talking about general systems theory mm-hmm. to a rather pervasive recognition of the necessity of thinking in systems, mm. including military systems, which have driven a lot of our thinking, mm-hmm. And engineered utilities like electrical, phone, and internet have us much more thinking about systems. Unfortunately, a lot of those people aren't focusing on the systemness, though. They're still much focused on tools and, this is a system, but without very much foundation to it. Yeah. So I think there's a potential hunger for it, too. When I started giving my talks to the systems engineers, I was surprised. There was some who were totally resistant, and some will always be, of course. But there was a hunger there for. And did I say this on the radio program, this trip to England that I went on recently for the International Society for System Sciences, which I... repeatedly add that I was responsible for that name when I was managing director. It was very hard to get it passed, but we did. And sometimes I regret that we did. But it was, you might figure, the strongest meeting for looking at system science. So I ran a system science session there. Only 4, 5, 7 people came to it. Mm-hmm. The very essence of the society. And one of the talks I was going to give there was proving isomorphy. It was the first time I saw that, and I used to run these conferences for many, many years. Only 4 or 5 people came to it. Mm-hmm. So everything they were doing there was social systems applications mostly.
Right, right.
This wasn't the essence of the society at all.
Right.
But I bring that up not so much because you mentioned I was using cycles as the case study, and I presented 52 case studies of cycling in all the disciplines, astronomy through human civilization, at all the scalar levels, to try to prove isomorphism. I thought that would be a great paper and attract a lot of people, but it hardly attracted anybody.
Right.
Because even the system-sensitive people aren't studying systems, really. And the point I was...
It's kind of like they're assuming that the concept is already there and solid,
and going on and applying it, whereas what you're saying is we need to make sure that it is really proven before we apply it, and in that process we're going to learn more than if we just take different concepts out of it. Whereas if we have a field theory of it and we recognize all of the system processes and we recognize linkage propositions across them, then we're going to have substance to give to people like systems engineers that don't know anything about systems. Mm-hmm. There will be some substance to give them as part of their training course.
As part, not all of it, but as part of their training. I mean, you stated it very, very well. For a lot of the soft systems methodology people, systems is a belief system. Mm. They believe it. Mm. I mean, a lot of people are born. Some people are born system sensitive, as I call them. They believe in the systemness. It's the detail that's missing, that's necessary, I think.
Is that kind of like paranormal sensitive, or is they call them sensitives and paranormal?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. There's things about our brain we can't understand at all. I mean, I love to read the neural literature on idiot savants, they used to call them. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible term. They don't use it anymore.
Right.
But there are people who have subnormal IQs, but who have huge capacities to do things in mathematics and in calendars and various manipulations. We don't understand how they do it.
Mm.
There are people also who've been documented who can remember what they were doing on May 14th, 1943. I remember because that's when I was born, but they can remember that whole day in explicit detail.
Right, right, right.
There are things in our brains, that if one person can do it, that means there is a capability for all of us to do it, but we just don't know. We trade off to be able to communicate normally and to have what we call normal consciousness. We trade off these capacities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you.
Right.
We are actually blinding ourselves to those possibilities, which made me lose the point entirely. When you say paranormal, no, it's these are all paranormal. So what we do in normality, it's almost like the original sin. In order to communicate and name, we gave up the vastness of the human brain, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting thought that that was the original sin, if you will. I mean, I'm just teasing, but
yeah.
That's enabled us to be what we call normal, but took us away from this. Like, well, system sensitives are people who actually have discapacities in perhaps memory or ability to focus. Maybe philosophers are like that also because, you know, they don't focus on the reality as much as other people.
Mm.
They can't remember the details, and so they only remember the comparisons, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, system sensitive is paranormal, you could call it that, but not in the usual sense they call it.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because what I notice is that we're going through a cultural shift, like you're saying, where systems are becoming more important, and I think that started at the beginning of the 20th century. And all through the 20th century, systems are becoming more and more important. Kind of as we are building systems, we're kind of becoming more sensitive to how they're there in nature already, and then you have people going beyond that to saying, okay, well, maybe we can learn from nature in how systems works to build better ones. And so what you're saying is that if we really knew something about systems, like we knew what the systems processes were and what the linkage propositions were for sure, then we could really do a lot better at building systems like systems engineering wants to do. But it seems to me that, like in business, you find very few people that are really into looking at things from a systemic point of view. And of course, when you find them, you know, if you're one of them, there's an immediate kind of connection. But it's like Kuhn said with paradigm shifts, you know, the old generation that believes in reductionism kind of has to die off, right, before you get the new paradigm fully manifest. And so I feel like we're kind of going through that cultural shift in some way where this is going to become more and more important, you know, culturally, probably over the next century.
But you bring up a horrifying possibility. And that is, maybe there's a built-in paradox. See, I say you should be both a reductionist and an analyst and a synthesist and an integrationist at the same time.
Mm.
But maybe it truly is an either-or phenomenon. You know how you get these images like the old lady who's actually a young woman?
Right, right.
The chalices, which are actually two people kissing.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever noticed, you can't hold both of them in your mind at the same time. I've tried and tried.
Right, right.
It shifts from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what I'm, and in fact, I don't like neologisms, I used to talk about anisynthesis because you want to do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's like this other thing. Our minds are built such that you can't do both at the same time. So what we're really trying to do with the linkage propositions and systems processes is do the analytical thing in a synthetic way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's discompassitance for human beings. I don't know. But it's worth a try.
But the thing is that the analytical part doesn't go away. I mean, you could always switch back to look at the analytical part if you wanted. But the problem culturally is that the system way of looking at things has been weak and is now getting stronger. And so then the best position to be in is that you can switch back and forth. But the system way of looking at things has been the weaker way of looking at things. And that's why, you know, certain of us emphasize that way of looking at things because so much is analysis and reductionism.
Yeah, you want to counterbalance the dominant trend.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I describe a system scientist as a person who's able to switch back and forth and not lose their place.
Interesting.
So in a sense, it's a way of flipping quickly back and forth between the old woman and the young woman and recognizing something that's common between the two, or recognizing the unity of the two.
Right.
And that, well, of course, that takes a lot because I find I've been booed at my own ISSS meetings in system science when I said that I'm an analyst and I still believe in reductionism. I've been
mm-hmm.
booed.
Mm.
And I was, you know, like a managing director and the guider of, you know, supposed to be the leader. And, that's because they were inescapable, what would you call it, inflexible holists.
Mm.
See, they were against reductionism.
Right, right.
See,
right.
You can't be a Shiite and a Sunni at the same time.
Right,
you could
right.
marry a Sunni or a Shiite, but
right.
then, or if you want to say a Serb or a Croat,
uh-huh.
and be in the same family. But as soon as they start dividing you up, boy, you kill each other, right? Trying to do both is a difficult thing. So I'm against people, I'm not against, but I would advocate more flexibility in people who are pure holists and systemists or integrationists or synthetic types in terms they need more analytical and vice versa. As you say, it's pretty clear what's dominant in our society, though.
So one of my favorite books is Bateson's Mind and Nature. And in that book, what he brings up but doesn't explain is why it is that you can, if you study two subjects at the same time, you get a higher quality of information than if you study them separately at different times. And so it seems to me that you know, kind of what you're talking about is doing that, you know, is saying we've gotten this idea of a system, but we didn't completely get it. And so we need to go back and do this proof to make sure that we completely understand this thing that we're calling the system that many people have seen in many different ways, emphasizing different aspects. Let's look at the whole field and then bring that forward as the view of what a system is, and then try to apply that. And that's how it's going to make the analysis better, because if we have that basis, so we know what a system is, and then we go back and do the analysis, you're saying the analysis can be sharper. And basically, to me, that's what Bateson is saying. If you take from the analysis side of science and the system type of science at the same time and switch back and forth across that paradoxical line between the two paradigms, then you're going to get a higher quality of information, and that might make science itself go to a new level. Like you're saying, like in physics, they want to have a,
general theory that covers everything, but we're saying there's a deeper general theory that's maybe more closer to math, where we can describe the constraints on phenomena on many different levels through the and understand the differences and the similarities.
And that's the way nature is. Nature is both simultaneously, particle and wave. It's both simultaneously.
Right.
A system and a system within all the other systems. So it's particulars and it's generals at the same time. It's just easier for us to study the particulars because they stick around a little more for us to do studies of.
Right, right.
And so in order to match this great duality of nature, we have to be ourselves both analytical and synthetic at the same time. And I might say that it will never happen, but I've devised a system science curriculum for college for the non-scientists, because all the scientists have very rigorous requirements of calculus and this physics and that for engineering or for biology. You know, I have to take a year of physics and chemistry for biology and probably more chemistry than that. They'll never give up those requirements. But I think, and I've been told by young scientists themselves, that it might be good for all scientists to take system science, because this is a treasure trove of hypotheses. I mean, it gives you ideas about how the great mysteries that are remaining for some of the sciences might be approached or solved. And yet, if you think in a synthetic manner that way, you're really condemned by the peer group in modern sciences. And so they'll probably never get this kind of education where it would actually be very, very beneficial for them. And I've talked with maybe 15 Nobel laureates over the years, and I found all of them, without exception, to accept some of these ideas much more rapidly and think far more generally than most of the what we would call the pedestrian sciences. God forgive me for saying that. They'll resent that. Mm-hmm. The people who do the lab work over and over again and you know, make assure us that it's not repetitious.
You can replicate.
You can replicate it, yes, which is the hallmark of science, and it's very important. And they make small advances, but the Nobel leaps usually come from people who are broader thinkers.
Interesting.
And I think those kind of people were system sensitives who were analytical too, to begin with. They just went the path of the analytical.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for this interview, and hopefully we'll explore other aspects of system science in the future.
We should look at some specific systems processes and the information therein. I found that when I give the full course and I talk about the theory, the students aren't as interested as going in depth under individual systems processes, because that's where the richness is. Although the theory is important too, it's just they get more tools to work with then.
Right.
But we'll have to look at whether we've covered the territory. I really appreciate Systems Radio. As I've told you, and this is an ad for the future, I'm going to try to get permission to add the verbal part of a video interviews of a couple, three Nobel laureates and famous people in the field of system science who were founders that were conducted by James Miller in the future to your series. And I think that'll help it a lot.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Ken Palmer, thank you very much for starting Systems Radio.
We did it.
Yeah, I didn't know how long we should go, but, you know, people who aren't as interested in you and I would go on forever. You and I could go on forever.
You talk a lot about a lot of different things.
Okay. Okay, luckily, yeah, that was pretty long. Last time I wanted.
How long?
102 minutes so far.
That's an hour and a half about, huh?
Wow.
Yeah, because the first 10 minutes was